to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. On this evening's program, some august company. Dr. David Schindler is off to London, not necessarily to see the Queen, but rather to join the ranks of famous scientists such as Sir Isaac Newton and Charles Darwin. This professor from the University of Alberta will now become a Fellow of the Royal Society of London. And someone who's looking for the next Einstein is Dr. Brian Unger. Only instead of rocket science, he's interested in researchers who excel in informatics. The point is to help Alberta become the new Silicon Valley. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. It's a long way from the Midwest potato farm where he grew up to the halls of the Royal Society of London. But in his characteristic way, David Schindler takes it all in stride. It's all part of doing good science. Presently the Killam Memorial Professor in Ecology at the University of Alberta, David Schindler has distinguished himself as an exemplary force in both public and scientific arenas since he first took on Madison Avenue in the 1970s. As a result of his pioneering research, phosphates were removed from laundry detergent. I first interviewed David more than a decade ago when he was a premier scientist with Fisheries and Oceans, and he very patiently explained to me the intricacies of organochlorines in pulp mill effluent. This is another area where industrial processes have changed as a result of scientific research. Among the many recognitions of his lifelong work, David has been awarded the Stockholm Water Prize and Alberta's Aztec Award for Scientific Excellence. And now, he is being inducted as a fellow of the prestigious Royal Society of London.
I'm very tickled about it because it's an organization that my scientific heroes going back to the 17th century belong to. Unlike people on the street who have sports heroes, scientists have science heroes, people like Charles Darwin and Isaac Newton. And those are two of the original members of the Royal Society of London, so it's a real delight to join those ranks. One doesn't become a fellow of the Royal Society unless someone nominates you, so very grateful to my friend Digby McLaren, who was the president of the Royal Society of Canada until recently and is himself a member of the Royal Society of London, for nominating me.
This is such an incredibly prestigious thing to have happen. What are they recognizing you for?
The work on nutrient inputs to lakes and its impact, and impacts of acid rain and climate change, the usual package, I guess. But the Royal Society of London usually looks at the straight scientific aspects, not the ramifications for society at large. So it's a testament that the science that I've done is right on, whereas a lot of the other awards have been for the application of the science. But some pretty rarefied company, one of the people this year is being recognized for inventing the World Wide Web, one of the new inductees. Another, Richard Dawkins, who is a fellow graduate student with me at Oxford at the same time, has written several important and controversial books, such as The Selfish Gene and River Out of Eden, is also being inducted, so it should be a fun time.
You've actually spent time studying over in England, haven't you?
That's right. In fact, my primary profs there, Charles Elton, who was my PhD supervisor, was a fellow of the Royal Society of London. Nico Tinbergen, who won the Nobel Prize for Animal Behavior several years ago, was a member. And Arthur Kane, who is a really well-known population geneticist, also a member of the Royal Society, were on my graduate committee, and they were my heroes. So it seems rather strange that I, a mere student, am joining them.
as a student, they must be awfully proud of you because over the years you've accomplished so much. What are the sorts of things that people are recognizing you for?
The last 7 months has been a wide range. The first of the seven was the NSERC Distinguished Science Award, I guess would be close to the title, which is strictly a science award. It's for the quality of science done and more or less for lifetime achievement. Then after that, I had three invited annual lectureships in a row, the Laird Lectureship at the University of Winnipeg, the Basterfield Lectureship at the University of Regina, and the Vollenweider Lectureship at the National Water Research Institute. And then following that, I got a conservation award, the Douglas Pimlott Award, which is an annual award for leadership and conservation made by the Canadian Nature Federation. And then yesterday I received an honorary Doctor of Science from Brock University, where I gave the convocation address. And then the final one will be the induction into the Royal Society in a couple of weeks.
Why is it that you're, getting so much acclaim right now? You've been recognized for your work for many years, but why right now? Is there something that's really sparked all this?
I don't think so. I think it's more just, I guess at some point you become so well known in so many fields that you become recognized for all sorts of things. I think for the lectureships, part of the stimulation was a paper that I wrote last year, which was predicting the course of our fresh waters in the new millennium. And I predicted some rather dire things, such as water quality problems, at a time when I, of course, couldn't have realized that Walkerton was going to happen. And when Walkerton and North Battleford happened, people started to think I was some sort of prophet. I predict the same thing for the demise of sport fisheries in Canada. None of this is rocket science. If you know the terrain, it's the handwriting is very, very clear, but we're continuing to go down this non-sustainable path at a very high rate.
When you look back over your career and the research that you've done up to this point, and I know that you've got many years ahead of you where you're going to continue doing the good work that you do, what principles do you bring to the work that you do to be a good scientist? What is good science?
Well, to select the science, there are a number of things that I look for. Probably the first is an important problem, but lots of people do that. The second thing is a tractable problem, one that I don't have to beat my head against the wall and hope that I might solve it, one that I can see some potential solutions. And that's often coupled to a third thing, some new breakthrough in methodology or technology that allows me to look a little farther or a little deeper than it has before. Then the fourth thing is whether I or students and colleagues that I work with have the skills to put all of that together. By that point, it usually is narrowed down to relatively few topics. And then on top of that, there are so many people messing around with industry money and so few doing science in the public interest that I've decided, regardless of the fact that I have less money to work with by doing it, I want to do my science in the public interest. I can remember how hard my family had to work for the tax dollars that went to funding government labs and universities and so forth. And those people damn well should expect to get something back. And I think that's been a bit of an obsession with me.
Well, when you talk about the public good, I think back 20 or 30 years ago when the result of your work with the Great Lakes, one of those things was the removal of phosphates from detergents.
Yes, that was probably the first one, and it was at that point where I saw how dishonest the sort of Madison Avenue approach to things that we see every day on our shelves, like detergents, could be. And it made me madder than hell. And I decided that people didn't need to make decisions based on propaganda, that they could really have science on the table to see what the issues were and what the solutions were before the decisions were made. So I think that was a turning point for me, and ever since I've wanted to do science on issues that were important to people.
You've mentioned a couple of areas, one being the demise of sport fishery. What are you going to be working on in the next little while?
That's a good question. I've got a number of things on the go right now and a couple others that I'm trying to start. I have three graduate students working on ultraviolet related problems. As I've explained in a couple of earlier publications, ultraviolet radiation is a special problem for fresh water, because not only is the decline in stratospheric ozone an issue, but also the decline in the staining in waters, which becomes increasingly bleached as we get drought and climatic warming conditions, sort of acts as a double whammy, increasing the exposure of these organisms to UV. So I'll probably continue in that line. With a couple of other students, I'm looking at effects of climate on small ponds and on the impact of alien fish species on communities in lakes in the mountain parks. And there's some new chemicals. Most people don't know that we have a new Dirty Dozen that'll replace the Dirty Dozen that we're signing off on, and some look potentially just as harmful. So if we get the proper equipment and operating funds, we're going to be trying to take some looks at some new PCB-like chemicals that are the result of manufacturing processes again, and again are carried in the atmosphere and biomagnified. There's substances known as polybrominated diphenyl ethers, which have very properties very similar to PCBs and have been invisible until the last few months. So those are some of the ideas. I'm always open to more, of course. One of the things that I feel should drive the program, so of university professors, is what their students are interested in. I don't recruit my students the way most people do. I have the luxury of having a lot of bright students apply. And rather than ripping a page out of my grant and telling them, do this and you'll get a PhD, I like to make them do what they'll be doing the rest of their lives if they're successful. That's designing a research program of their own. So I make them sort of fumble through the steps to deduce a good research program based on those four criteria that I mentioned earlier. And as a result, my overall research program tends to go a lot of different directions depending on the talents of the students. And if they end up with something that's beyond my expertise, I usually try to draw in a co-supervisor so that they're adequately supervised and mentored on the subjects that they're working on.
Just listening to all of different things that you're doing and all these plates you're juggling, and even on the way up to do the interview, there's a poster beside the elevator about a new course that you're teaching in the fall about fresh water and the concerns that we have. How, as an academic and a scientist, do you really accommodate all of these things that are required of you, the teaching responsibilities, the supervisory, you have to keep publishing and coming up with new ideas? How do you do that?
It's a tough job. I sacrifice a few things. Both my office and my house look like absolute disasters, like I live in piles of paper. Some of the rest isn't so bad. One thing that having my salary paid by the Killam Trust has meant is that I'm free from any teaching duties that I don't want. So with the urging of the dean and my department chairman, I've concentrated on courses that I think are critical, such as the one you saw advertised, and on giving lectures in other people's courses where I can spare them some effort by giving lectures that I already have taped in my head rather than making them scramble for hours to put together something up to date. But I don't have to do the paperwork and the grading and so forth of the students afterward. And then I've concentrated on graduate students. But my big shortcoming is the slowness with which I type. If I could type at a rate that would keep up with the rate that the gears in my head turn, I'd have 1,000 publications. So that's the hardest part, is just to get things down on paper in some intelligible form.
When is it that you actually head off to London?
I think it's the 10th of July. We have a two-day seminar given by new fellows of the society, followed by a day-long induction ceremony and celebration. So it should be quite interesting.
Well, our thoughts will certainly be with you as you head over there, and it's been an honor to speak to you today.
Thank you for coming and interviewing me, Cheryl.
That was Dr. David Schindler, Killam Memorial Professor of Ecology at the University of Alberta, and now a fellow in the Royal Society of London. And you can see for yourself just how those gears turn in David's head. I've posted on the Innovation Alberta website the convocation address he gave to the graduating class at Brock University. Coming up, Alberta vies to become the informatics center of the universe. Speaking of scientific geniuses, if Dr. Brian Unger has his way, Alberta will be full of computer-savvy Einsteins within the next few years. Brian Unger is one of the motivating forces behind the wiring of Alberta. A professor of computing sciences at the University of Calgary, Brian is also the president and CEO of ICOR, and ICOR is the acronym for Informatics Circle of Research Excellence. In this new age of informatics, Brian believes Alberta is poised to become the next Silicon Valley. In less than a decade, Brian has helped Alberta develop an incredible infrastructure that links universities and researchers, and soon the public, in an ever-growing superhighway of super networks.
I guess one of the things that started for me was an organization called WorkNet. I was one of the founders of the Western University Research Consortium on High-Performance Computing and Networking, called WorkNet. And we started by building an advanced data communications network across Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta, connecting the five major universities in those three provinces. And that was the first in Canada. It was the first of its kind in Canada, and it really brought Canada into the back into the communication age. Advanced communications. Canada was really behind. We'd been a leader, you know, decades ago, and I think we'd fallen way behind, and a group of us got together, and that was our initiative. Today, Canada is second only to Korea, South Korea, in terms of broadband internet connections. We're ahead of the U.S. in terms of the number of people that have broadband connections to the internet. So a lot has happened since 1993 when I started getting involved in WorkNet and building that organization, which today is called Natera, the Natera Alliance. We pronounce it Natera. It's spelled like Net Era. And it was a great idea that has supported a number of other initiatives, which includes high-performance computing initiatives, which are called MACI, the Multimedia Advanced Computational Infrastructure Initiative, which is an Alberta-based $20 million organization and initiative.
What is the point of bringing out all of this stuff, of trying to connect everybody this way?
Well, for me, I think the major objective is really economic diversification, supporting the diversification of the economy from oil and gas, from being dependent on oil and gas only or primarily, and agriculture. The next generation, our kids, are very interested in the internet and communications, and the question really is, are they going to have an opportunity to have interesting, exciting jobs in Alberta, or are they all going to have to move south west or east. And I think there's been a lot of cases where our brightest children, grow up, do degrees at universities, and then leave. So Alberta is like a small town of North America.
That seems awfully ambitious, trying to bring all of this Silicon Valley stuff into Alberta. Is it really very realistic?
Well, it is. It is really a challenge. It's a steep challenge. But the government has been committed to putting Alberta on the world map in terms of information and communications technology. One of their initiatives is called ICOR, the one that I lead at the present, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence. And ICOR is aimed at attracting renowned scientists into Alberta, into the universities in Alberta. And this, we're looking at really the smartest and the brightest and the most exciting people that we want to bring in information technology areas. And the rationale behind this is if we can get a few really excited people who have everyone knows about and have a following, then we can attract graduate students, we can attract junior faculty, we can produce graduates who will start companies here and who will possibly stay here.
What is it, though, that would really bring them here? I know that's the goal, but what actually is going to make them want to come here and stay? What kind of research or work would they actually be doing?
Well, I think if we have some really outstanding research leaders here, that's one thing that'll bring them here. But there's also the issues of infrastructure. And Alberta's in a great shape in this sense, because we have this MACI and the new West Grid initiative, which is to acquire really very significant computing resources and online storage resources in the province, plus the fact that we've got one of the most advanced regional networks in the world in Alberta that Natera has built. The networking, the computing resources, and the people is what's going to bring people here.
Is this something that's going to be accessible to the public, or is it only within the research community?
Well, I think that the basic ideas and the innovation comes from the research community. If you don't have the research community, you don't have startup companies and spin-outs, and you don't have the opportunity for people for young people to find interesting jobs and to stay in a particular location. But it is for everybody. I mean, if we think about what the internet has done, we have grandparents sending email to grandchildren and parents staying in touch and families staying in touch over thousands of kilometers, which is the way our culture seems to have evolved here. It's difficult. It's rare for families to stay in the same location. And so the internet really is a way to keep people together, to be able to stay in touch.
You've come a long way in a very short period of time, in just 8 years. What are the challenges for the future?
Well, I think it's always a beginning. We still have resources to recruit good people into the universities. And we want to recruit the best graduate students that we can recruit, and we want to keep the best graduate students that we have in the province as well. So I'd say for the future, it's more of the same. It's more of the same, and it's focused on people as well as on building our infrastructure. And it's working with the government to try to keep our eyes on this goal, which is to diversify the economy, to build an information technology center and centers in Alberta.
Now, I've seen a few press releases about funding that ICOR has given out. What are some of those projects?
We've, in our first year of operation, we've basically, I feel we've done very well. We've funded five groups or five senior people. For example, Norman Beaulieu in the Electrical and Computer Engineering Department at the University of Alberta is working in wireless networking, and he is building a research group. We've put in half of over $7 million over 5 years to build his research group and to fund his graduate students and his project. We've also funded people at the University of Alberta in nanotechnology and in high-performance artificial intelligence algorithms. At Calgary, we funded people in Graham Julian, who's a chair in microelectronics design and development, sort of the next generation chips and electronic systems. We also have in the computer science department at the University of Calgary funded Kerry Williamson, who's working on internet algorithms and wireless PDAs, you know, the your Palm Pilot device that can be wirelessly connected to others, say, for example, students interacting using their PDAs and interacting with faculty and over the internet as well.
You've talked about things like nanotechnology and artificial intelligence, but I mean, for me, that's just way over my head. How do you apply this to people's everyday lives?
Information technology really has applications in every area of our lives. Healthcare, for example. It's possible that the best neurologist in Alberta will be able to consult with doctors that are far away and who have patients with particular problems, and they can consult over the network and get expert advice, things that wouldn't be possible without the networks and without the computing power too, because you want to be able to store images and retrieve images and send images across long distances within the province. So there's all kinds of applications for artificial intelligence, automatic recognition of tumors, say, for example, and mammograms is something that some of our researchers are working on. There's applications in education and remote education so that our students that are in small schools in remote communities have access, the same kinds of access to libraries and information and expert people as people in the cities have, or as the students in the cities have. So education, health, I think both have major application areas for advances in information technology.
All of that hinges, though, on people being able to connect. Is that going to happen?
Well, that's another one of the government initiatives is to build SuperNet, which is going to connect everyone in the province. We're really looking forward to seeing SuperNet built. It will be another advance that Albertans will have major advantages over other parts of the world in terms of their ability to interact with each other and also to connect to major information sources.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Well, thank you, Cheryl, for the opportunity to do this. I've enjoyed talking to you.
That was Dr. Brian Unger, a professor of computing sciences at the University of Calgary, and he's the president and CEO of iCore. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Visit our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. You can download past programs or listen to them on Real Audio. And this week, you can read Dr. David Schindler's convocation address to the graduating class of Brock University. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.